Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. We design, craft and install beautiful kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
First this morning though, hundreds of targets attacked, a string of top leaders wiped out and smoke billowing from one of Iran's major nuclear enrichment sites. Israel's overnight assault on its Middle East rival, carried out apparently without the support of the United States, has seen tensions in the region spiral, with all eyes now on how Tehran will respond. Well, a little earlier I spoke to Shashank Joshi, defence editor with The Economist, for his analysis of the situation, and I began by asking him why Benjamin Netanyahu felt that this was the right time to launch this attack.
I think that at the macro level, it was looking at an Iranian nuclear program that was growing in size and scope with ever more enriched uranium capable of being enriched further into bombs. But at the more narrow level, I think it also saw that US-Iran nuclear talks were faltering, that there was maybe less prospect of a deal coming out of this that would contain Iran's nuclear program. And of course, looking at the last year or so, it looked ahead and saw an Iran that was severely weakened, with both Iran and its allies like Hezbollah in Lebanon severely weakened by last year's skirmishing, and thought that if it took this action, the retaliation it would face now would be far, far less than that which it might have expected if we were having this conversation 18 months ago. Mm-hmm. And so that combination of factors, I think, drove it to conduct this attack. I'm skeptical about its public claim that it saw imminent intelligence about an accelerating nuclear program. I'm skeptical of that.
You're skeptical of this claim by Benjamin Netanyahu that Iran has enough fuel to quickly convert into 9 nuclear weapons.
I'm not skeptical of that.
Right.
That's true. Iran has, you know, upwards of 400 kilograms of uranium enriched to more than 60%. 60% is a very, very short distance in enrichment terms from weapons grade, which is 90%. And that is enough for quite a few bombs if enriched further. And that could happen fairly fast. So he's not wrong there. However, you still have to turn that into a weapon. You still have to then mate that to a delivery system like a missile. And Iran's nuclear program, it was broadly halted in 2003. There were some elements that continued, but there was no decision to build a bomb. From Israel's perspective, what they'd say is there may not have been a decision to build a bomb, but they were putting all the bits in place that would have allowed them to do so significantly quicker. And so Israel was effectively like a boiling frog.
How effective will the strikes be, though, from Israel's point of view? Will it merely slow down but not stop Iran when it comes to its nuclear program?
The consensus is that it will generally slow down the program. It will delay it. But we don't know. And in fact, they haven't even struck all the nuclear sites yet. They haven't struck one of the most deeply buried and important sites, Fordo. And that's pretty interesting. I'm sure that attack will come in later rounds of attack. But the fact is, we don't know how much their bombs have penetrated into the ground at Natanz, which is the other site that Benjamin Netanyahu mentioned. We don't know whether they've just taken out the shafts and the tunnel entrances, or whether they've done much more damage to the centrifuge halls where the machines are which spin the uranium gas and turn it into enriched uranium. So Until we know those details, we simply won't know. They have, of course, also killed a number of Iranian nuclear scientists and senior leaders, and that will undoubtedly disrupt the program. But I don't think it will necessarily prevent Iran from pushing the program underground and trying again.
Tell us a bit more about Fordo, this site, which I was reading about this morning, which does seem to be, and you might explain this to us, buried very much underground. And until you get at that one, you won't stop Iran's nuclear program. Is that right?
Well, I'm not sure we'd single it out alone, but it is the most deeply buried of Iran's sites. It was built by the Revolutionary Guards, the IRGC, near in a mountain near the city of Qom, which is a holy city in Iran. It's got these two big enrichment halls, and each of them holds lots of centrifuges that spin uranium. It began construction 2007, and it was revealed by America, Britain, and France in 2009. But it's not the only one, and we know that Iran has been digging in other places near Natanz, right into the mountain, looking at the amount of soil that's coming out. You can see they're making some pretty big cavernous spaces underground. So, all of that, it raises questions, because it's not easy for bombs to get 80 meters below a mountain. It really isn't.
And how much do you trace all of this back to Donald Trump's decision to pull out of the nuclear accord in 2018? Because it's believed, isn't it, that from that point, Iran then ramped up their nuclear production facilities.
I think that really a lot of this dates to Trump's pulling out of the JCPOA. Now, the JCPOA was a deal that made sure Iran's breakout time, the time it would take to enrich enough uranium for a single bomb, was more than a year. That was a huge success. It wasn't perfect. The deal had sunset clauses, which meant that over time, Iran would have been able to introduce ever more advanced uranium centrifuges, and over time would have eased up the restrictions on what it could do. So Iran says actually eventually it would have put Iran back in that position. But compared to the situation today, where Iran has accumulated all the material I've talked about, it looks like a great deal. And so Trump's decision to pull out of that, it not only freed up these restrictions on Iran, it also allowed Iran to kick out IAEA inspectors or restrict their access to a degree. It limited the UN's insight into Iran's program, which has made it more likely Iran would be able to divert nuclear material or centrifuge parts to other places, to secret sites. Mm-hmm. And so I think, had we been in the JCPOA today, I just don't see Iran's program as being as developed and sizable as this.
And the United States is in a sticky position this morning, isn't it? Because they've said they weren't involved in the action. They warned Iran then not to attack its personnel or interests. But then you have Tehran saying, well, Washington must have known about this and given permission at the very least for it to happen. So how does the United States deal with the fallout now?
I think the US is in a conundrum because it clearly didn't participate in the strikes. It wants to distance itself because it must be slightly irked that this diplomacy on the weekend's been disrupted. But on the other hand, it knows that an Iranian retaliation towards Israel is coming, and that we've already seen drone attacks. It will probably escalate further into ballistic missile attacks at some stage, I would suggest. And therefore, America will need to help Israel defend its airspace, much as it did last year. Without American help, Israel will suffer much more damage from any missile strikes that occur, and it will also need replenishment of its interceptors and other ammunition. So the Americans will probably have to step in, but they'll want to do so in a way that doesn't then invite Iranian retaliation against American bases and embassies in the Middle East, which are in far closer range of Iran than Israel is. Think about places like Bahrain, Kuwait, just across the Persian Gulf. And that is, I think, the decision that will face Donald Trump when he wakes up today and meets his National Security Council in the Oval Office.
Mm-hmm. Because we know that he does not want to get involved what he sees as foreign wars. That's where his red lines are.
I think that it's more complicated than that because, of course, he just spent a good month bombing Yemen very heavily indeed. So he's okay with some type of foreign wars. But on the other hand, you're quite right that he doesn't want entanglement of the kind that many of the people around him associate with Iraq and Afghan type nation building. They really are neuralgic about that. And so they will want to avoid any sense that Israel's campaign might turn into regime change or that it will result in a kind of huge war that will drag in America, not least because, of course, their focus is on China and they want to be able to shift military resources to the Pacific, away from Europe and away from the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. So how quickly do you expect Iran to retaliate? I mean, you spoke about how they had been shaken after the skirmishes over the last year or so. Do they have the capacity to retaliate quickly?
They have already done so with the drones, but in terms of their missile forces, I think they'll be in some disarray because the head of the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guards, the head of the Iranian Armed Forces, the top political advisor to Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who's called Ali Shamkhani, he's been killed. They've all been killed. So the high command of Iran will be in some disarray. And I think that they will be debating and asking themselves, what do we do next? And how do we calibrate it? And how do we keep it in check? So they will be in some disarray. And I would expect proper retaliation to take a little bit of time. I wouldn't expect it just today, straight away, on a large scale, at least.
Shashank Joshi there, who's defence editor with The Economist. Now, the French President Emmanuel Macron is going to hold a defence cabinet meeting following those large-scale strikes against Iran and Tehran's promise of a robust response. When it comes to Germany, the Chancellor Friedrich Merz got a call from Benjamin Netanyahu after those strikes had happened. And then after that call, he convened an emergency security cabinet meeting in Germany. Let's cross live to the United States. And I'm joined by journalist Sarah Firth in Washington. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Shashank Joshi was just saying there that Donald Trump will have some really difficult issues to grapple with this morning when he gets going with his day. We've already heard from the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who issued a statement overnight saying that this was unilateral action by Israel, something that's not quite accepted by Iran. Can you tell us a bit more about what we've heard from the American administration in relation to all of this?
Yes, so we've heard from the White House that President Trump will be convening his National Security Council around 11 a.m. local time. So we know that obviously they're going to be discussing Israel strikes in Iran. But I think what's important to note in the immediate aftermath of this Israeli operation that they've dubbed Rising Lion is that you had, as you said, that statement from Secretary of State Marco Rubio saying that this was Israel taking unilateral action against Iran, saying very clearly that America is not involved in the strikes against Iran and that their top priority is going to be protecting American forces in the region. Of course, you have had the pushback from Iran that have placed, they place partial blame on the US, saying Washington is the primary patron of Israel. Very important to note, though, in the statement that's come from the Secretary of State, you have had absent, which a lot of people here have noted for the first time that most people can remember, the wording that usually comes, which is that the United States stands behind Israel. That is absent in this case. And so what with the information that's already been released, there's not really any other way to read it other than the fact that it is clear that the Trump administration doesn't seem to support this action. We've also had a number of reports from here in the US, from very well-sourced US reporters, saying that the US did notify its allies in the region. It's thought some 30 minutes to an hour before Israel launched those strikes. And in that warning made clear that President Trump wants peace. So there are going to be a few big questions that people are looking for answers to now, one of which, very importantly, is the US is distancing itself very clearly in its language in a way that we haven't seen for a long time in the past. So you haven't got that strong language of support for Israel. But of course, you have very clearly got America tied in with Israel when it comes to defending against any retaliation that you will have from Iran now as a result of these attacks by Israel. So the question is, how involved will America be? And really what we haven't heard from Israeli officials, and they've been questioned quite heavily in the immediate aftermath, is what are they expecting in terms of the backing from America when it comes to that defense now with the expected retaliation? Because Iran are going to be viewing this, you know, unequivocally as an act of war from Israel. Israel saying that they've launched this to defend their nation, the US making that distance, making it clear that there is a distance, they don't support this, but they are very clearly going to be involved to some degree in the defence. And it's how much Israel is going to need and be expecting from America and how much America is willing to give.
Well, we'll hear more from America, no doubt, as the hours go by. But on a separate issue, Sarah, I wanted to ask you about that astonishing footage that I think a lot of people will have seen at this stage of the Democratic Senator Alex Padilla being pushed to the ground and handcuffed. He was trying to ask questions at a brief which was held by the Homeland Security Secretary Kirstie Nome in Los Angeles. What has been the response to that?
I think there's been a lot of shock at Padilla being restrained and taking out when he was trying to question the Homeland Security Secretary at that press event. The video is sort of, it's gone obviously pretty viral here in the United States. He was restrained and removed by Secret Service and FBI agents. So he was trying to question the secretary. You saw him being pushed back towards the exit. And the response has been pretty severe. You've had Padilla, who's a ranking member of the Judicial Committee on Immigration and Citizenship. So this is around the raids that you've seen taking place across the country and the pushback from the likes of Padilla about what is seen as a very extreme immigration enforcement and these actions that the Trump administration are taking. He has said that if this is how the administration responds to a senator with a question, You can only imagine what they're doing to the farm workers, to the cooks, to the day laborers throughout the LA community and throughout California and throughout the country. Now, Claire, we're expecting those protests that you've seen in LA pushing back against the immigration enforcement agents that have come in and been trying to carry out these immigration raids. They've spread to other cities already. At the weekend here in Washington, D.C., you've got a major military parade taking place and planned protests across the country. So this is a situation domestically that is definitely escalating. Mm-hmm. You had overnight, of course, the news sort of buried in this breaking news coming out of the Middle East with Israel attacking Iran in this way. But you had the news that California essentially suing the White House administration, suing President Trump for what they felt was an illegal action when Trump sent in the National Guard, has deployed those Marines. The court finding, it seems, that the National Guard and the actions and directives will be placed back in the hands of Governor Gavin Newsom.
Okay, we need to leave it there, Sarah, but thank you very much for joining us. I see in the last couple of minutes, authorities in India have reported that they have recovered one of the black boxes from the crash site of the Air India aircraft, and we'll be bringing you more on that as we go through the morning. Turning back to the Middle East, though, we're hearing as well, it's been said on X in the last few minutes, that the Iranian President Masoud Pezeshkian is due to make a speech shortly. Let's get more on this now. Danny Houston, Head of Financial Analysis at AJ Bell. We want to find out, Danny, what the response of the markets has been to this overnight attack. And in particular, what has the impact been on the price of oil?
Yeah, I mean, the price of oil has seen the biggest impact. So it's set for the biggest one-day gain, Brent crude, since 2022, of course, when Russia invaded Ukraine. So just to give you some idea, Brent crude up currently 7% at $74.20 a barrel. It's been hovering around $64 a barrel, so a significant increase. And a lot of people will remember what happened to inflation, to the pound in their pocket, when we had the last oil price increase, because it does filter through to all of us. First of all, we'll see a change in the price at the pump. Second of all, oil was used in all sorts of things, plastic, chemicals, packaging, delivery. So that will potentially impact the prices for everything that we're paying, and therefore, of course, filtering back through to inflation and potentially affect rate decreases by the European Central Bank and others over the course of the next year or so, depending on what happens. Obviously, this is one day. This is a snapshot. Markets, you won't be surprised to learn, we've seen equities, the stock 600 is down. United States futures, they're down around 1% as well. Asian markets were down similarly. And those safe havens that people flock to when things are a bit dicey, things like gold, well, that is nudging back up towards the record that was set earlier this year as investors really look to put their money somewhere where they can feel that it's not going to be impacted by all this instability. But you've got to remember, about 30% of the global oil supply comes from the Middle East. Five out of the top 10 oil producing companies are there. And it's less about the current situation, the conflict between Israel and Iran, and more about what could potentially happen. There's a particularly important stretch of water called the Straits of Hormuz, which last year was impacted by Houthi rebels. And if we start to see that being impacted, then clearly that affects shipping.
Danny, thank you so much. Danny Houston there, Head of Financial Analysis at AJ Bell. And in the last couple of minutes, there's an Iranian news agency reporting renewed strikes this morning by Israel on the northwestern city of Tabriz. And we'll bring you more on that as we go through the day.